Hi, and welcome to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock with this week's selection of highlights from the Labor Radio Podcast Network, more than 50 labor radio and podcast shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. On this week's show,
we are tired of hearing about all the jobs that are being reshored when we know our members are out of work, when we know their jobs are still going to China, when we know their jobs are still going to Mexico. And what we really need are real solutions that are going to put U.S. workers back to work and put our economy back together.
Owen Hernstadt, chief of staff at the Machinists Union, takes a look at Joe Biden's new manufacturing proposal on the latest Activate Live podcast.
So our specialty is fire. We don't go out and look for pulling people over for DUIs. We don't look for domestic violence.
Right.
But when we do show up on scene, it's incredible because we have the knowledge of being a fireman and we're able to see the fire for what it is.
Arson investigator Captain Ramon Martinez on the Firefighter Kingdom podcast.
I've been mentioning on our recent programs how excited I am that Labor Express Radio is now a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. A network of now over 50, and it keeps growing, labor movement-oriented radio programs or podcasts from across the USA. I never knew that there were so many of us out there. And that is one of the network's goals, to make all of us more visible to all of you out there. So to celebrate this new partnership, I thought I would provide you a small sample of what the network has to offer. A sort of coast-to-coast tour.
Labor Express Radio host Jerry Mead Lucero highlights reports from the Workweek podcast on the West Coast, the Heartland Labor Forum in Kansas City, and the Building Bridges radio show in New York City.
You're paying $120 a month to make $2,000. I said, go to any non-union company and get that $2,000 from them and have health insurance and have a pension.
Mark and Jeremy talk union dues on the Break Time Breakdown podcast.
This board has overturned well over a dozen precedents, and in every single case, it's been in favor of an employer and against workers and their unions.
Labor lawyer Joyce Goldstein on the Trump National Labor Relations Board on America's Workforce Radio. That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices. Here's the show.
Coming up, a closer look at presidential candidate Joe Biden's manufacturing proposal. Activate Live starts now.
Activate your voice. Activate your voice.
Speak up. Speak out. Get involved. Get involved.
Engage-toi.
Take action.
Activate deine Stimme.
We're union and we're proud.
Welcome to a special edition of Activate Live. I'm Tanya Hutchins, coming to you from Machinist Union headquarters in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. Presidential candidate Joe Biden unveiled a comprehensive manufacturing plan last week that his campaign calls its Build Back Better agenda. Now, the goal is to create millions of jobs and restore millions more lost this year to the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining us now to give us some insight is IAM Chief of Staff Owen Hernstadt, who is also a trade and globalization expert. Thank you for joining us, Owen. Biden says that this plan is to ensure the future is made in all of America by all of America's workers. What do you say to that?
The plan that was announced is a comprehensive plan. It involves not only government procurement, trade, labor law reform, investment in manufacturing, investment in innovations, but it does all that with the main idea to create jobs here and to bring back those jobs that have gone offshore. So a comprehensive program like this we haven't seen since the Great Depression. We have millions and millions of manufacturing workers and workers in other sectors of the economy out of work. Even before COVID, we experienced the loss of 5 million manufacturing jobs. So a comprehensive plan that would put in place a framework for not only bringing jobs home, but creating jobs is really quite welcome. The issue about Make It in America is an incredibly important one. When we use things like Buy American, those goods should be made by U.S. workers, it means we need to reform current Buy American laws to make sure that is indeed accomplished. From my view of the Biden plan, it goes a long way to achieve that. It acknowledges that if for some agencies, in some cases, if something is only 51% made in America, it qualifies for Buy America. That's a low figure. But more importantly, it acknowledges the need to make sure that the way Buy American percentages are calculated are a true reflection of a domestic U.S.-made product.
I know when it comes to Innovate in America, China is on track to surpass the United States in terms of research and development. How does the Biden plan address this?
There's $400 billion that will go into government procurement, particularly aimed at the infrastructure, clean energy. But in terms of the innovation issue, it apparently also would have $300 billion that would promote innovation, research, development here at home, which is so desperately needed so that the U.S. can regain its competitiveness with other countries in the world, particularly countries like China. We've seen over the years things like semiconductors, which the U.S. was so prominent in leading the development of, move offshore when it came to manufacturing. So when it comes to things like advanced technology, innovations, all of the new things that will spur new industries that will promote not only U.S. manufacturing and U.S. manufacturing workers, but that will sustain our future for years to come, seem to be certainly part of the plan, combined with all of the other things in it, like closing tax loopholes, which actually promote corporate offshoring, as well as quite a few other things. We are tired of hearing about all the jobs that are being reshored when we know our members are out of work, when we know their jobs are still going to China, when we know their jobs are still going to Mexico. And what we really need are real solutions that are going to put U.S. workers back to work and put our economy back together again.
Thank you so much, Owen Herbstadt, Chief of Staff to International President Bob Martinez. We'll see you next time we do a special edition of Activate Live.
All right, welcome back to Firefighter Kingdom. Today's a great day. I have a good friend of mine, Captain Martinez from Fire Investigation Division. So how did you get involved in the fire service?
It was never something that I grew up thinking I want to be a fireman. I had an uncle in the fire service, Gary Pribble, who's retired. But he would call me up when it was a weekend and he'd say, hey, are you home? Yes. Okay, well, pack, you're coming with me for the night. So I'd get my stuff and I'd get a sleeping bag and a pillow and a change of clothes and he'd pick me up and I'd go work with him at Station 11 for the night and do a ride along. And I did that 3 or 4 times and that kind of sparked my interest.
In Albuquerque, fire and rescue at Station 11 pays pretty hard, right?
11 was busy. So,
yeah, so you guys are really need some calls there, right?
Missed my first call there. I slept through my first call there. So.
Oh, yeah. That will never happen again, though, right?
It was pretty neat. I got it out of the way.
So yeah. And then you went to the academy, of course, became a firefighter. And
I went to the academy. I was 22 years old. Went to AFD's academy. Got in. Did the academy, you know, did piping. I promoted to driver right away. And actually, during the fire academy, the fire investigators came into our class and they gave us their spiel, talked about their credentials and their background and what they did on a daily basis. And ever since then, I was hooked. I knew that's what I wanted to do and knew what direction I wanted to go.
So how long were you in the field?
It's been off and on for probably about 7 years.
Cool.
I got promoted to driver, drove for 3 years, finally got into arson, went to the police academy. And when I graduated from the police academy, there wasn't a spot for me in arson right away. So I went to the police academy and had to come back out to the field. Went back to my truck. I was driving ladder 15 at the time. And when a spot opened up, I took it and came into arson as an investigator.
I mean, not everybody could do that. So there weren't two easy academies. So it was a police academy. Police academy is a lot easier, I'm sure, than fire academy, right?
You know what?
Come on, man. Tell the truth.
I'm very grateful for both of them. They just both teach a very different way.
Sure.
For the police academy, it was very regimented, very structured, and very long. 6 months academy. So we're there from, 5:36 in the morning to 5:36 at night, 5 days a week, plus whenever they called us in on weekends. So the time that it took was difficult. As far as the fire academy, the physical fitness and that aspect was pretty tough. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. Right. And I went in as a little puppy, man, and I graduated as a puppy, I'm still a puppy, but I put on, I'm one of the few that put on weight in the academy just because I'd never trained like that.
Right.
So grateful for it, grateful for every minute of it.
I've been around the country teaching firefighters all over the country, and a lot of them don't have the law enforcement aspect of it. They have to use their local law enforcement. I don't think a lot of people understand that you guys actually carry a firearm, you guys carry handcuffs, you guys can actually arrest people,
right,
and you're police officers.
We're all commissioned law enforcement officers. So our specialty is fire. We don't go out and look for pulling people over for DUIs. We don't look for domestic violence.
Right.
But when we do show up on scene, it's incredible because we have the knowledge of being a fireman and we're able to see the fire for what it is. And then once we determine that there was actually a crime that was committed, we're able to flip, without skipping a beat and put on our, police officer shoes. And now we're looking at it from the police side and saying, okay, how can I articulate what happened?
Right.
Who did this? Why did they do this? And then from there, we do the investigation, the documentation. We take our own evidence. We do our own photographs. We do our own interviews. We write our own arrest warrants. So we do the whole nine. But there's nothing lost in translation.
Right.
That's the benefit that we have from most places throughout the country and definitely the state. We're the only ones that have the hybrid system. As a firefighter, I don't have to look at an investigation and then tell you what happened. And then you as a police officer that has no idea about fire has to write the report for me, the criminal report. So, yeah, we're blessed and I love our system.
On the structure arson part of it, man, how successful are you guys to actually prosecuting people or actually finding them and prosecuting and actually holding up in court and putting them in jail or prison?
Right. Arson is the hardest crime out of all crimes to solve. So right away, we're already behind the curb. It's extremely difficult. However, our division has a long track record of having fantastic numbers that are typically above the national average.
Division. Don't try to start fires in Albuquerque, right?
Yeah, I hope not.
Captain Martinez, like I said, and he'll be after you.
My boys will get you.
Well, thanks again. I'm Robert Sanchez. Captain Martinez is here. And Vince Trujillo, always want to thank him. Thank you for everything, brother. Signing off. Have a good day.
You're listening to WLPN 105.5 FM in Chicago, and you're listening to Labor Express Radio, Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. News for working people by working people. I'm your host, Jerry Medlacero, and this is the Sunday, July 12th, 2020 edition of Labor Express. I've been mentioning on our recent programs near the end of the hour how excited I am that Labor Express Radio is now a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. A network of now over 50, and it keeps growing, labor movement-oriented radio programs or podcasts from across the USA. I never knew that there were so many of us out there. And that is one of the network's goals, to make all of us more visible to all of you out there. So to celebrate this new partnership, I thought I would provide you a small sample of what the network has to offer. A sort of coast-to-coast tour. One of the benefits of the network is the sharing of resources and content. So let's get started, and like the weather, we're going to start in the west and move east this time. This week I stuck with longtime comrades, and Steve Zeltzer of the Labor Video Project in the Bay Area of California fits that bill.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Pacifica, and today we're with Kim Cordova. She's president of USCW Local 7, and they're having a memorial today in Greeley, Colorado, to memorialize the workers who've died as a result of COVID. So welcome to the show, Kim. Can you talk about what has been happening to your members in these companies and why you're having the memorial today?
We represent 3,000 workers at the JBS Greeley Beef plant, and that plant was really hit hard with COVID-19. and it's really hit a lot of our members who are essential frontline workers. At our JBS plant, we lost 6 workers to COVID, 1 woman and 6 men. And this is a really big loss for not only our union, our community, and for their families. What we've seen around the country is that there's a systemic problem in these packing houses. It's the nature in which they work. They're elbow to elbow. When COVID first hit our community in Colorado, reaction to COVID by these employers were late. It was late. And it was inadequate.
Why hasn't the government ordered proper health and safety measures? And what has been the role of OSHA in Colorado with your members who are in danger of COVID?
What we've seen with the president's executive order is that they're putting profit over people. And while we have an order to keep plants running, whether there's workers that are sick in the plants or not, the government did not put in place any enforceable or verifiable safety laws, and no federal agencies or state agencies to enforce it, any type of safety laws or guidance. OSHA and the CDC, they're just guidance recommendations, but they're not enforceable. With President Trump's executive order and with an immunity shield, there's no incentive for these companies to protect the workers. These workers are important. They had a heartbeat, they had a soul, they had a family and communities that cared about them. And they're important to continue the food supply chain going. You have to protect the worker if you want to continue to have them feed our communities.
And also, I understand that these companies have sued your union to try to shut down the media that you're doing, getting the information out. What is the purpose of that, and have they been successful?
They sent me a letter threatening to sue us. They have not filed a lawsuit against us. They threatened to sue us, said they were going to try and get an injunction on us to stifle our voice. But that hasn't happened yet. I understand our constitutional rights. I have an obligation to stand up as their representative and to fight for these workers' rights. They're not going to just check our voice. We have a right to stand up and advocate for these workers and an obligation.
We've been talking with Kim Cordova, who is on her way to a memorial for the 6 workers who died at meatpacking plants in Colorado. So thanks for joining us on Pacifica, Kim.
You can check out Steve's podcast at soundcloud.com/workweek-radio. And you could find a link to his program by going to Labor Express Radio as well. Judy Ansel is the producer of the Heartland Labor Forum based in Kansas City, Missouri on KKFI, Kansas City's independent, non-commercial community radio station.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. The Guardian reported that more than 36,000 meat processing and agricultural workers have tested positive for COVID-19 since the pandemic began. And at least 116 have died, according to the Food and Environment Reporting Network. That's an underestimate, as some companies are withholding information.
David Maraskin, he is the Food Project Senior Attorney. He focuses on impact litigation to promote sustainable alternatives to the industrial animal agriculture system. He does constitutional consumer worker and environmental cases. David Maraskin, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Judy. All employees have a right to a safe workplace. We pursued with something called public nuisance. And what public nuisance recognizes is you can run a business, but you can't run a business in such a way that it makes a generalized danger to the public. And our view is that COVID is a generalized danger to the public. And what Smithfield was essentially doing and is essentially doing today, still unfortunately, is turning its meatpacking plants into incubators for the disease that will then get out into the environment.
I read that Milan, Missouri, which is where the Smithfield plant is, and the counties around it have become a hotspot. Is that correct?
Smithfield decided to begin testing its workers at the plant. What that testing revealed was rampant spread of COVID among those workers. And it's continued since then, and we now have spread in the community. And Milan and Sullivan County, which is the neighboring county where most of the workers live, are now some of Missouri's highest ranking spots for COVID and some of the fastest rising at 1.2.
Isn't OSHA supposed to take care of this?
OSHA was never structured to take care of this. And I think that's something to recognize, is that OSHA is just not built to deal with this. It would take OSHA something like 100 and some odd years to inspect all the workplaces around the country in the best of circumstances.
Right.
Just isn't staffed to do this. And it's certainly not staffed. It's not structured to move quickly. That being said, OSHA certainly has authority and is supposed to protect workers. It just historically has always been very slow and ineffective at doing so. OSHA requires 6 months to issue a citation in most instances. There's a decades-long appeals process. I think OSHA employees all have their heart in the right place. This isn't about the workers. It's about the funding of that agency and the structures that have been put in place in Congress that it can't really accomplish its goals. The saddest stories that we've heard are both the ones about meatpacking workers bringing the COVID home to their family and then family members dying, and also workers and their families going on ventilators and the companies allowing that they plan to continue to operate as is, even while workers are on ventilators. There's just gross negligence and disregard for the employees here.
Thank you very much, David Maraskin. We'll keep tabs on this story.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can find out more about the Heartland Labor Forum through the KKFI webpage at kkfi.org/program/Heartland-Labor-Forum. And our final stop in this brief tour lands firmly on the other water's edge, the East Coast, and the greatest of great U.S. cities, New York, along with Chicago, of course, are tied as far as I'm concerned, to catch up with an old friend of Labor Express that regular listeners to Labor Express will know very well. Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash host and produce what I would argue is in many ways the gold standard and the granddaddy labor radio program of them all, Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City. Mimi and Ken interview none other than Carl Rosen of UE about unions, Black Lives Matter, and the police.
The labor movement's offered some very nice statements in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. When it comes to action, when it comes to the kind of proposals you're talking about, when it comes to joining the demonstrations in the streets, what do you think the labor movement has to do?
There are places where there has been good work done by folks in labor in support of this. You know, you had the West Coast Longshore, the ILWU,
right,
shut down the ports on Juneteenth. That was very significant. And a number of the labor organizations that are lined up in terms of based on the different racial and ethnic groups and the Coalition of Union Women, et cetera, have been trying to engage to some extent. But it is true that the larger section of organized labor has either been silent or at least not present. The labor movement as a whole has a long way to go on this, but there are elements within labor that are working hard to bridge some of those gaps.
And I wonder if you can talk about the special representation or the agenda that you would like to see more firmly implanted in the Black Lives movement to broaden out the issues that affect the working class, that affect black and brown workers within the working class. What is to be done?
It's clear that these protests are largely of and by people who are part of the working class. The neighborhoods where the greatest repression is taking place are working class neighborhoods. And so I think there's already a lot of commonality of issues. You know, we need Medicare for all in this country, for everybody, but it's needed more than anything for people in the black community. This is a racial justice issue. All of the things that are needed for black people that are deprived to them relative to everybody else, whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whether it's social services, whether it's good jobs. Black lives matter for all of those issues. And that is the working class agenda. And so I think really it's not a question of the movement for black lives trying to broaden out its agenda as much as an obligation amongst in the labor movement and amongst everybody who wants to stand in solidarity here, understanding that these issues are there and they need to get behind all of them.
You can hear more Building Bridges at their website, which is buildingbridgesradio.blogspot.com, and links to all the Labor Radio programs that we featured tonight that are part of the network, as well as all the previous episodes of Labor Express Radio, can be found at laborexpress.org. Again, laborexpress.org, so check that out. Labor Express is a proud member of the Labor Radio and Podcast Network, working people's voices, broadcasting worldwide 24 hours a day. Find out more at laborradionetwork.org. Tune in again next Sunday at 8 p.m. or Monday at 11 a.m. on 105.5 FM or lumpinradio.com for more Labor Express.
It's time to put down the tools, take off your hard hats, and devour last night's leftovers as we discuss facts, lies, and miscommunications in the Sheet Metal Workers Guide to Local 110. Brothers and sisters, friends, family, strangers, and foes, welcome to the Break Time Breakdown. Okay, so we're sitting with the Financial Secretary Treasurer of Local 110. He also happens to be the business manager. Mark Adams is with us, and we're going to discuss dues today, how to read your dues receipt, where the money goes, how it's collected, and the importance behind keeping them paid. The common gripe about dues when you talk to like a non-union sheet metal worker, they'll bring up dues a lot and say, well, you have to pay to work. And that's not true at all, but it's definitely the propaganda way to look at it. Mm-hmm. And so as an organizer, I'll find out what they're paying for the benefits that they have, if they have any. And usually what I've found around here is if someone's paying to subsidize his own health care through a non-union sheet metal company, they're paying anywhere from $65-$70 for a single person to up to $170 to $200 a week for family coverage for insurance. And I let them know that those are their non-union dues that they pay, because we don't pay those costs. We're sheet metal workers by trade, and our business is being in a union. It is my business, and the dues I pay every month is the overhead to keep my business working or keep my lights on. It's like paying a utility for my company. That was the easiest way for me to accept the due structure. You get a whole lot for what we pay, man. I understand the personal responsibility is a big chunk, but for what that covers, I mean, It's a great deal. It's a great deal.
I used to be a general foreman at a car manufacturer, and I had pushed about 50 men, and I'd hear it all the time. The guys going, oh, we're paying these dues. They're going up again this year and blah, blah, blah. But I said, at the time, you're paying $120 a month to make $2,000. I said, go to any non-union company and get that $2,000 from them and have health insurance and have a pension.
Yeah.
But they hate it worse than anything. But yet we still got a lot of money in that. And a lot of people draw a weekly check during the virus here. The last few months people have been drawing a weekly check for a month. People have it for unemployment insurance and everything. So we got a lot of benefits that other people do not have. And I tell you, that amount that we draw for that we give for them dues is a drop in the bucket, in my opinion.
Our dues are based off of our Constitution. So the Constitution lays out how your dues are paid and how we come up with that number. And it's based off of a couple of different factors, like the size of your membership.
The size of the membership, if you have 100 members and less, it's a different percentage if you have 20,000 members or less, or more, So it's all based off of how many members you have. So there's a percentage behind every one of those numbers right there. We at Local 110, we got a 3% on the total package. Everybody wants to go off of your pay. It's not off the pay. It's off your health insurance, your pension, and then your pay is what you'll have to base it off of. So if you get a raise within the year on your pension, on the health insurance, if that money goes up, then that means that'll be a difference in your dues right there.
Too often we forget about the invisible income. There's money being paid, even though it's not reflected on our paycheck, but there's money going into different funds and accounts.
That is your money as such that gives you your insurance. Once you get to so many hours a month, then anything above that will go into a fund that you'll have there. So if you was to get laid off, that you could draw back out of that fund, or if something happens that you can't work for some reason, but for all the months that you got laying, that money you got laying there for months, then you could literally draw insurance for a long time.
So yes. Just understand it's a very small price to pay for all the things that we get. And I would challenge anyone that has any kind of content towards paying dues, talk to some non-union workers and see how they're doing with their non-union dues, because yeah, they exist. They exist.
They exist. They do exist.
They pay for a lot of stuff that they should not have to pay for. And so that would be my challenge from this episode. But anyway, Mark, thanks for sitting with us. That's all I got.
That's great. Thank you, brothers and sisters. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care, everybody.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferentz.
Well, it may be summer recess for schools, but not for educators. A demand for the Senate to go back to work. Big labor win in Georgia. Painters speaking out on infrastructure. And today on the show, the latest from the progressive populace and how the Trump NLRB has shut the lights on labor. Joyce Goldstein will be joining us. Goldstein Gregel is her law firm, and they specialize in all kinds of union activity, contract negotiations, law enforcement, public-private sector. Joyce Goldstein, welcome back to the broadcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Flash. Thanks for having me.
Today, we are going to talk about the National Labor Relations Board and how they have ruled pretty much against workers over the last several years here. Why don't we go back in, what is in the 1930s? Was it 1935 when this board was created? Let's start there just to educate our listeners on what the National Labor Relations Board actually is and what it should be doing. So let's start there, Joyce. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you. So the National Labor Relations Board was established as one of the New Deal programs from President Franklin Roosevelt in 1935, and it was established for the purpose of giving workers rights, the right to organize and engage in collective bargaining. The board is a 5-member board by statute, appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate. And that's been, the law has been essentially the same law since 1935. It was amended in 1947 with the Taft-Hartley Act, and those amendments were designed to restrict union power. And of course, it's been dependent upon the 5-member board to implement it and enforce it. And that has changed over the years, depending on who the president is and who gets appointed to the board.
Mm-hmm. So when there's a Democratic president, you have 3 Democrats on the board, 2 Republicans, and vice versa when there's a Republican in the White House. But right now, I guess it's not fully staffed. We don't have 5 members right now. Is that my understanding?
Typically, there are 3 members of the majority party, whoever is the president in office at the time, and 2 members of the minority party. So there is always some balance, but obviously more weight given to the majority party that's running the government. That's not the case now. Instead of having a 5-member board, we actually right now, and since the end of 2019, we have only had a 3-member board. And the 3 members are 3 Republicans, all of whom were appointed by Trump. They're 3 white men, no women, no people of color, and no Democrats. And that's really significant because Democrats historically appointed to the board have issued decisions more favorable to unions and workers. And conversely, when the Republicans are in charge, they issue decisions that are more favorable to employers and are anti-union and anti-worker.
Now, what we're seeing, especially with this board, I mean, it sets labor precedent, as you pointed out. They're taking a look at old decisions and kind of revising them, and they're not in favor of unions.
Back at the beginning of the Trump administration, the Chamber of Commerce publicly issued their agenda of what would be most favorable to employers that they'd like to see the NLRB do. The Republican-controlled NLRB has completely implemented the Chamber of Commerce's agenda that was put out there in early 2017. This board has overturned well over a dozen precedents, and in every single case, it's been in favor of an employer and against workers and their unions.
Unbelievable. Well, I tell you, there's a lot more, and we'll save it for the next show. How's that sound, Joyce? Because
great.
it seems to be a never-ending story here. We appreciate your time. Professor Goldstein, we learned a lot today on the show, so thank you very much. You have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you in August, okay?
Great. Thank you so much.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
This day in labor history, the year was 1919. That Friday, thousands of workers in the Chicago stockyards walked off the job. A serious union organizing drive had been underway in the yards since June. One of the organizers of the butchers was John Kikulski. John declared it would be a campaign that included workers who were Polish, Irish, Lithuanian, and in fact, every race, color, creed, and nationality. This was an important pledge because earlier unionization efforts had failed to unite the workforce and had often excluded black workers. Yet the years of racial barriers to unionize proved hard to break down. While 90% of the white workers joined the union, black recruitment lagged behind. Tensions between the newly arriving Eastern European workers and more established white workers also simmered. Despite these setbacks, the stockyard owners were alarmed by the success of the union drive. They sent in 300 mounted policemen to disrupt union meetings and monitor the workers' movements. Angered at the police presence, 10,000 workers walked off the job. They returned to work on Monday, but began organizing for a strike. On July 26th, the workers issued their demands to management for better pay and safer working conditions. The next day would be one of the most infamous days in Chicago history. A group of white Chicagoans stoned and killed a black boy who was swimming and had accidentally drifted into a whites-only part of Lake Michigan. For the next week, a race riot engulfed the neighborhoods surrounding the stockyards. 1,000 black families lost their homes to arson. 23 black and 15 white residents were killed. Any hope of racial unity had been crushed, and as a result, the strike failed. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Just a small sample of the amazing programs aired recently on more than 50 labor radio and podcast shows. They're all part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you, stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited this week by Evan Papp of the Empathy Media Lab, a production house, artist studio, and an event space here in Washington, D.C., with a focus on labor, political economy, and art and culture. Find out more at empathymedialab.com. This week's show was produced and mixed by me. Our social media guru is Harold Phillips. You can always reach us at laborradionetwork.org.